I am Platt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. In his new book, former Prime Minister Joe Clark makes the argument that Canada needs to reassert itself internationally and once again take up its position in the world as an agent of change, diplomacy, and peace. The book is called How We Lead Canada in a Century of Change. In it, Mr. Clark, who joins me now, provides a narrative that includes our past successes and histories that have provided the world much benefit, as well as an increase in our reputation abroad. He castigates Stephen Harper and his government for hastening this decline and offers solutions. I'll get Mr. Clark to tell us about the ideas in the book, the lamentations, and the possible solutions he has. Joe Clark was first elected to the House of Commons in 1972 and became leader of the Progressive Conservative Party in 1976. He was elected Prime Minister in 1979. He served as Canada's Minister of External Affairs from 1984 to 1981 in the Mulroney government, and in 1991 to 1993 was President of the Privy Council and Minister responsible for constitutional affairs. He returned to the House of Commons in 2000 before retiring from politics in 2004. His website is righthonorablejoeclark.ca. That's also his Twitter handle. Incidentally, Mr. Clark will be appearing at Capilano University later this month, Monday the 25th of November, at 7:30 p.m. For tickets and information, go to capilanou.ca. This new book is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Platt on the Line program the 16th Prime Minister of Canada, the Right Honourable Joe Clark. Mr. Clark, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Happy to.
So in this book, you talk a great deal about how Mr. Harper has handled things, his leadership, especially in terms of foreign affairs, and a bit into, say, national affairs. It's no secret that you've had reservations about him for a long time. The genesis of that and where we are today. Do you think that the sort of doubt you had to him suggested where we are today? Like, did you know that this was how his government was going to turn out, perhaps?
Let me step back just one moment, because the book I wrote was designed to talk about what we can do in the future, and I thought the only way I could get there entailed an examination of where we are now and why, and it was in that spirit that the criticisms of the Harper government arose. I was concerned at the time of his appearance on the scene that he and others like him had an uncommonly narrow view of what I guess I could call the polity, the political system, that it that would be the case on domestic policy, particularly social policy. And I was concerned about their international reputation, although, like most people, I really had no idea what it was, because it was not a prominent part in his becoming leader of the of the merged party, or indeed of the country.
Now, there's a great talk about the Senate and its future right now at the Supreme Court. It's also been talked about in elsewhere in the discourse here in the country. You touch in near the back of the book about the great national discussions we had on Meech Lake in Charlottetown. In hindsight, had those passed, do you think the country would be in a better place today, and we wouldn't be at this place where the Senate could be abolished shortly?
Well, had Charlottetown passed, of course, we would have had a Triple E Senate, elected, effective, and equal. And that was opposed, among others, by Mr. Harper, vigorously. And I don't quarrel with the judgment of Canadians in that referendum. It is interesting to note that we did secure unanimous agreement on that proposal for a new Senate. Every province, every territory, and indeed the Aboriginal leaders who were around the table. Also, I think that one of the principal concerns of the Meech Lake Accord was that that Quebec had not come to support the constitutional agreement introduced by Mr. Trudeau, and that was remains a very serious wound in the fabric of the country. So in those cases, we would have been better off. I think there's no doubt that some of the changes we sought to introduce, particularly in Charlottetown, might have caused some new tensions of their own. But I hope that they would also have established a practice of moving forward by agreement rather than through the adversarial mode that has become much more common.
Mr. Kretien had great success not talking about big national questions like the Constitution, and I suppose Canadians were fatigued after the patriation after Meech Lake and Charlottetown. But do you think we're ripe now for tackling constitutional change, say something with regards to Aboriginal reform, perhaps?
First of all, in Aboriginal reform, while constitutional change in time has to be a part of it, the major issue on Aboriginal reform is for the larger population to understand and take very seriously the condition of Aboriginal people and some of the causes for that. There is in place, because the courts ordered it, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that has been very successful in having people tell the truth about the terrible things that happened to them in residential schools. The issue of reconciliation has not been addressed as fully, and while there are constitutional aspects of that, the point I want to make is that that requires a change in attitude of large majorities of Canadians. And I hope that, and it requires an indication that we can find agreement between our Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Canadians on important issues. I mean, one of the suggestions that was put forward some years ago and didn't move forward but could indicate a good news story was the idea that there should be an Auditor General for Aboriginal Affairs. I think that would achieve agreement across the board, and it would change the picture we have of Aboriginal issues, that picture is now far too dominated by illness and anger and failures. And I think bad news almost always trumps good news, but there is an enormous amount of good news with regard to Canada's Aboriginal people that needs to be told. At this stage, it's not a constitutional matter.
But there should be national conversations, don't you think, big ones?
Absolutely, there should be. Yeah. Our country was, we're a country that had to be built. The people who live here had to create the country. We're not an island or something whose lines and borders and population were created by geography or something else. We always have to build this country, and we've done that, usually after long national conversations. The talks before Confederation was established were a conversation. And if you look back, Medicare came from a Royal Commission. The Free Trade Agreement was first suggested by a Royal Commission. The creation of national cultural institutions was first established by a Royal Commission. Those instruments have been very helpful national conversations, and we haven't had one now for 7 or 8 years since the one-person Roy Romano Commission on health care. We don't even have the traditional Canadian constitution or conversations involving leaders of federal and provincial governments. So the Prime Minister will not call meetings of First Ministers. He prefers to deal with them one-on-one rather than as a whole. And quite generally, the practices that used to be dominant, including in Parliament debate in a more generous time, more generously spirited time, led to real agreement on things we could pursue together. We face a very serious problem that we are not talking to one another, first, and secondly, that there is not a discussion and a development in public of national goals that could continue the Canadian practice of building this country to meet modern times.
Do you think this is the way it's going to be under Mr. Harper or anyone else? I mean, is this the trend, do you think, in our Canadian political life?
They certainly have not indicated that they're a consultative government, so I wouldn't expect that they will take the lead on this. Part of the reason I wrote the book when I did is that I think a discussion of international policy does not need to await government leadership. It would be better if it did. Virtually all past governments, maybe all of them, I guess with the exception of mine, I wasn't there long enough to do it, but past governments have always set out a white paper or a green paper suggesting international goals for Canada. This government will have nothing to do with that. And so, absent leadership by the government, is it feasible to think that Canadians who are concerned about these issues could develop some kind of consensus of their own? After all, we're very much engaged as citizens in the world. We're speaking on a day when there is a terrible, terrible disaster in the Philippines to which Canadians as citizens and as organizations are responding. And while there are some very important federal agencies of response, some of the most impressive are not federal at all. They're charitable organizations, they're faith groups, they're individual actions by people and communities. We're an engaged country internationally. We're engaged in international trade. We have people working for international organizations and for non-governmental organizations all over the world. World Vision, which is whose president now is a Canadian, has thousands and thousands of people working on front lines of conflict around the world. So our nature is internationalist. And indeed, there's been a larger debate recently, the last 5-10 years, among the people who are sort of professionally interested in international affairs, the Canadian International Council and others. I think that debate could be broadly expanded, and I hope that this book, by suggesting 3 or 4 things we should be looking at, if we're going to build as strong a future as an earlier generation had built a past, I hope the book might stimulate a lot of discussion, not only about what we could do, but how we could do it.
Now, do you think that NGOs will usurp the role of government? And if so, what should the relationship be between our government and various NGOs that you've mentioned already?
Well, let me take the second question first, what the relationship should be. It's been a fairly awkward, contestive relation for a long time for a very good reason. Non-governmental organizations are precisely that. They are not governments. And there is a risk sometimes, they feel, sometimes with reason, that they will be co-opted or that they will lose their authority in the field if they become too closely involved with governments. Some of that is real. Some of that is simply an attitude that I think gets in the way of some NGO leaders considering ways they might adapt in the future. But how might we do it? We've got some classic examples of how to do it. I was privileged to be the foreign affairs minister in the fight against apartheid, and I'm immensely proud of what foreign service officers did. But they would be the first to say that people who made the real difference were some of the NGOs who were on the ground, were the trade union movements. And, you know, I think back to that time. It was a time when the Mulroney government, of which I was a part, did not have the best relations with the Canadian Labour Congress generally, but we worked closely, very closely, with the Canadian Labour Congress, which had its own relations with the major trade union movement in South Africa, and played an important role in dealing with apartheid. That's one kind of example. The other kind, that is even more compelling in many ways, is how Canada achieved the international treaty on banning landmines. There was a very powerful group of NGOs who were urging that kind of change. There were some governments that were interested. Too many governments did not give it a priority. So Canada, instead of limiting itself to the traditional way of doing international business, entered into a partnership with the NGOs that resulted in an international treaty. We should be asking ourselves, what is the next issue like that? If landmines was one issue, are there other issues? They need not be as dramatic or as sweeping as the landmines were, but let us put together a list of 8 or 9 or 10 issues where that kind of cooperation should go forward. And the last word on NGOs, I frankly think governments could be more easily persuaded to enter into this kind of partnership than the leadership of some NGOs could, because of this natural concern about retaining their independence, but I believe we can find a way around that.
Now, the book talks a great deal about how we've moved away from our traditional role, where we've exercised a soft power, and we're more concerned, it seems, with hard power, especially our role in Afghanistan and the sort. On soft power, talking to, say, other countries and groups and the sort. I mean, we haven't done very well in terms of, say, under this government, they've closed embassies. There's an upcoming Commonwealth heads of government meeting, and apparently we won't be there. Is that correct?
Correct. That's correct.
Yeah. So that's not a trend from this government that, you're particularly enamored with?
No, I think it's a big mistake because, first of all, Canada has to be multilateral. We're too small with all of our size and all of our wealth and power and brains. We're too small to be able to change things on our own. We have to rely with others, rely upon others. That's why, for example, years and years ago, when the World Trade Organization was first being talked about, it was, in fact, a diplomat from Vancouver, a Canadian diplomat from Vancouver, who was the first chair of the group that determined how we might put in place a World Trade Organization. We knew we needed cooperation with others. And not only do we have that long history, ranging through the United Nations, the Commonwealth, La Francophonie, all sorts of other ways, but we have great skill at encouraging those kinds of relationships to be established and then making them work. We are a highly successful country internationally because people trust us who very often will not trust other governments. People will come to us or take guidance from us that they would not take from the United States or the United Kingdom. You know, going back to Mr. Pearson's great achievement, Canada's great achievement, in establishing peacekeeping. In fact, some of the central ideas for that initiative came from the U.S. State Department. But the U.S. State Department did not have the capacity to speak with General Nasser in Egypt as easily as Canada would, or to other members of the non-aligned movement, the soon-to-be non-aligned movement, who were allies of Nasser's. Canada could. Canada could do what others couldn't. Canada could still do what others can't. And that means we should be working, we should be assigning a very high priority, as we have historically, to making these organizations of different nations work together.
And certainly if the embassy in Tehran were closed when you were prime minister, we wouldn't have had, say, two movies on it already, right?
Well, and we wouldn't have got the six American hostages.
Exactly.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the additional factor to that, I mean, Iran is a quite interesting case. It's obviously a power, and it scares a lot of people. And if you were an Israeli, if I were an Israeli, it would scare me because of the things that its leaders have said, apparently with public support. But it's a power. You can't condemn it away. It's not going to disappear. It's going to continue to have significant influence. So you have to find ways in which you can work with it. And I have no idea, really, frankly, why Mr. Baird closed the Iran embassy. But he did that in a certain set of circumstances. And as happens in life, as happens in diplomacy, those circumstances change. And what is one of the most hopeful developments right now? Suddenly there is a breakthrough in discussions on nuclear questions with Iran.
Yeah.
And where is Canada? Away. And other countries that it's not just a question of being in the negotiating team. We would not have been there. It is a question, however, of having the kind of advice and trust and contacts that could help people who were on the negotiating team. That's what excellent diplomats do. We have excellent diplomats. We shouldn't be keeping them at home.
Now, you talk to people around the world, leaders and the sort. Do people around the world suggest to you that we aren't, as Canadians, thought of as highly as we once were?
Oh, most of the people I run into internationally and most of the people my international friends run into in different circles say, where is Canada? What has happened to Canada? And that's not just my view at all. That's not even just the view of people who are otherwise critical of the Harper government. There's a general sense that Canada, the active country at the center of international events for half a century, has now drawn back. We drew back from Kyoto. We are critical of the United Nations. We do not go to Commonwealth conferences. The Prime Minister, when he's speaking at La Francophonie in the Democratic Republic of Congo, suggests that future meetings to discuss democracy should only be held in countries that are already democracies. That's not the Canada that John Diefenbaker represented, or Lester Pearson, or me, or Brian Mulroney, or a long range of former Canadian leaders. And it's noticed. Of course it's noticed. And the other thing that means is that we were exercising that kind of leadership in an earlier time when other countries were not able to.
Yeah.
A Brazil was not as able to. India was not as able to. A China was not as able to. They had their own significant problems. Mexico was not as able to. Well, these countries are now growing strongly economically, and they are developing their diplomatic and other capacities. If we create a gap, they will fill it. And that's important, not least because our prominence in the past depended to a large degree upon our economic strength. We were invited to join the Group of Seven economic powers because we then had the seventh largest GDP in the world. We'll never be seventh in GDP growth ever again in a world with Mexico rising and Turkey rising and Nigeria rising and Korea rising and Vietnam rising, not to mention India and Brazil. It's not so much that our economy is falling, it's not, and it's certainly of critical importance, but so are others rising. And so we have to base our appeal for influence in the world on both our economic strength and our military strength, but also upon these softer power capacities, our ability to do things that others can't.
Mr. Clark, do you think that the argument could be made that the government is acting the way it is simply because that's where the Canadian public is, and perhaps Canadians aren't keen to what it once was, that we're more concerned perhaps with the price of gas or cell phone rates?
I think we've always been highly concerned with the price of gas or cell phone rates or this sort of thing. But, you know, if there were an overwhelming mandate for the Harper government, voter turnout would not have declined steadily as it has since it came to office. It would not have to rely upon a base of 30% or less of the electorate. I think it is fair to say that a number of Canadians are not particularly interested in these issues, but I think it is a real stretch to say that the Harper government has any kind of substantial mandate for this kind of action. They didn't campaign on it ever, it's not what elected them. A lot of people who have been active in international affairs are very despondent about what Canada is doing. So no, I don't think there is, in any sense that means anything, a Canadian mandate for this. I think that to some degree they've been able to get away with it because people thought there was no alternative. The reality is there are alternative ways for Canada to act. And as I said, I don't think it's likely that the government itself is going to generate the kind of discussion we need about how we pursue those alternatives. But I think there is a large, large number of Canadians who are interested in these issues and who would be prepared rise to an opportunity. The question is, how do we provide that opportunity? I hope my book begins to make the case. But then I hope my book has an afterlife, that it causes people to take a look at my arguments, say, this one's pretty good, this one's pretty bad, here's a better one, and come to some agreement on things that we can do together.
Are there specific people, leaders, say, who are good alternatives in your mind to Mr. Harper? Parties, political parties, perhaps?
I think it's a hard time for political parties because, unfortunately, our politics have changed in two ways. One, they are driven by sort of impersonal devices, polling, robocalls, all these things that that unfortunately are practiced by all parties to one degree or another. And secondly, I can say this as someone who was a leader of the opposition for a long time. It's very risky for opposition parties to propose new changes on which they can't act. It was always clear to me, can't act in their present position, they can't act in opposition. Okay. I always knew when I was leader of the opposition that if I came forward with a new proposal, the people who agreed with it would say, well, that's interesting, but of course he's not in power. And the people who were opposed to it would say, well, that's it for him. It's a risky business. So I'm not sure we're going to get any bold or should demand any bold changes proposed by opposition parties, particularly in an age where once one says something, there is now such an organized attack to try to distort it and to take that person down. I'd like to have it different, but I don't think it is, just as I don't think it's different in the United States or indeed in the United Kingdom. That's just a reality of modern politics. So, is there a way in which this highly connected, intelligent, quite sophisticated, highly literate world can take the interest that we show in natural disasters, take the interest that we show when we support our Rotary Clubs or our churches or other organizations that are active internationally, and begin to think ourselves about areas where we can be more effective as a country. I think if we do that, it will have surprising results, maybe if only that it creates an informed body of opinion whose conclusions will have some impact upon the candidates who run in the next federal election.
Now, you write in the book of this adolescent, combative, and full of sound and fury tone coming out of Mr. Harper, and whenever you do speak, as you have on various issues in the last few years, and especially now with this book coming out, people talk about the frustration and disappointment you have with this current government, and much is made of the antipathy between you and Mr. Harper. Is the personal nature of that, is that overplayed, do you think?
I don't think either one of us much likes the other, but I don't. I would hope that we can be judged on what we do and what we say. And I'm not writing this, as I said earlier, to attack Mr. Harper. I'm writing it because I need to describe what we have done and how we have got there. Remember, my concerns about Stephen Harper go back a long time, and I, in fact, have been quite quiet about expressing them. I intervened in the first election he ran when I was asked the question by a journalist, and I said of Paul Martin that I would prefer the devil we know to the devil we don't. I wasn't out campaigning for any other party. I don't have any other party. I don't have a party at all. When I vote for the best candidate I see. And when I'm on those occasions when I have urged people to support a member of a party in an election, it's been on a personal basis. I've urged people to support Scott Bryson, the Liberal in Nova Scotia, whom I esteem. I urge them to support Chris Alexandra, the Conservative in Ontario, whom I esteem. I urge them to support Elizabeth May and others, but I've done that on a personal basis. So I've been pretty quiet and holding to myself on my views of the Harper government. I can't discuss where we should be in foreign policy without giving some attention to where we are now and some analysis as to how we got here.
Do journalists ask you who you vote for in elections?
They do, and I tell them it's a secret ballot.
the Toronto Star, in reviewing your book, called you the conscience of the nation. Do you see yourself as fulfilling that role in our discourse today? And I guess Canadians are taking to your message. A lot of Canadians are receptive to what you have to say. Have you noticed?
I think there is. There is a much broader interest in the arguments in this book than I had anticipated. I think the nation has a conscience. There are a lot of consciences in the country and people who act out of conscience. For a variety of reasons, I've been able to win sort of an unusual respect in the country. I think part of that was that a couple of my roles in public office were as nonpartisan as you can get. I had to lead a constitutional discussion, which is necessarily nonpartisan. I was a foreign minister, which at its best is the least partisan of portfolios, and I think that people came to identify me that way. And of course, I've been through a lot of ups and downs. People have had an ability to judge me on who I am, not on what image maker makes of me. So I think I may have some capacity to encourage others to express their conscience and to have a view that it is important, if you believe in things, to speak for them, to act for them, and that there will be others who will do that with you. I think that's a role I can play, and I'm quite pleased, in fact, that there seems to be a quite positive response to at least parts of my message in the book, and I very much hope that we can find ways in which we build on this to give these ideas an afterlife.
Will you shortly write a chronicle of the ups and downs, an autobiography or a memoir?
I'm not young anymore, so I'm not sure how long I'll be be writing things. I'm interested in doing some of that, not necessarily all the details. I frankly don't think there's an overwhelming audience for what I was doing at 6 or 7 or even 16. But what I may do, if I get time and a little help, I may, for example, sit down with some of the people, the really extraordinary people who worked with me because they were members of the Foreign Service, and take a look at some of the really important issues we faced during the period I was Foreign Minister and explain what they were, how we faced them, why we did what we did. I'd need to do that with others because I was merely the minister in many of those cases. It was the diplomats and the Foreign Service officers who did most of the hard slogging and know all the inside stories. But it would be useful to do because there were several instances where Canada made a real difference. And it's quite helpful, I think, for Canadians who are interested to know how that happened. What was the real story behind Canada's response, for example, to Tiananmen Square, which was a very broadly based stance that worked better than most and maintained good relations with a difficult ally. There's a range of other questions that I think would benefit from that. Do I have the energy to do that? I don't expect to do it in the next several weeks, but maybe after a rest from this grinding book tour, I may consider doing that.
Yeah, well, that's what, in reading the book, that's what I was looking for. I was looking for insight into what you thought on various things and sort of detail. And I think that there's parts of this book that certainly could be expanded. It's a book that's given me, certainly, a lot to think about. I appreciate the time today. Continued good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
The website for more, RightHonorableJoeClark.ca. The book is called How We Lead Canada in a Century of Change. It's from Random House. Its author, the Right Honorable Joe Clark, joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plata.